first started out in comedy, and then it was, I remember saying to my artistic director, comedy is pain. So that is a painful experience, but it's comedy.
That's right.
So, that's where good comedy comes from.
From despair and pain and,
it's from getting frustrated and annoyed at everything.
Yeah, like that whole thing
of accepting the messy world and saying, haha, here I am.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
We want to debate, investigate, and entertain.
Join us as we challenge the human experience
by speaking to people who impact the world through art.
Chapter 2, Podcast 1, Maysa Abizaid.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
And I'm Nick Kane.
And welcome to the Act of Storytelling, Chapter 2, specifically Podcast Number 1.
Yes, indeed. And we would first of all like to show our respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, of elders past and present, on which this podcast recording today takes place.
And unless you've been living under a rock or not keeping up to date with our social media excitement, it has been almost 6 months to the day since we last shared a podcast with the world, which is a little bit longer I know, it's crazy, isn't it? It's a little bit longer than we were initially hoping, but actually think it's been a really great amount of time because you will see a significant shift in everything that we, well, hopefully you'll see that we've been up to on the Act of Storytelling. And it's pretty exciting, isn't it, Nick?
Yeah, it is. It is exciting. So let's recap. In case you haven't heard it, here was a little snippet of our update on the change that we blasted across social media around about a month ago.
Our goal through the Act of Storytelling is to help people feel empowered to create change in their own lives. The storytellers that inspire us are people who are changing society with their art.
Yeah, they're the ones that are pushing us forward. And I guess in doing so, they're inviting us to challenge ourselves.
So this is it, our new mission.
So instead of sharing the human experience, we want to challenge the human experience.
Over the coming months, we'll be speaking to people who are impacting the world through art.
So as you can hear, we're about to go on a wonderful journey that sees us speaking to people who impact the world through their art.
And we're really excited today to be bringing you the first taste of what all of that will mean. But before we do, I'm really excited, Nick, to hear what the last 6 months have held for you.
Oh, I've missed this, Lauren Bailey. It's our monthly chat. I've missed it.
It makes it sound like we never talk.
Yeah, I know, right. Yeah, we do talk. But, you know, on air. This is our chance to talk on air and share it with the world. So I guess the past 6 months for me has been a massive time of transition in regards to my performer's landscape. So, you know, I think most people will know the podcast. Yes, okay, we've got a new focus and a new purpose. So everyone knows about that. But at the same time, and it almost aligned perfectly with our chats with the podcast, I decided to look for new representation and a new agent. And so pretty much up until now, I've been looking for that agent. So it's once again aligned that I now have a new agent, which has allowed me
to
transition. Yeah, thank you. It is exciting. It was a long process. But it's nice. It's a freedom. It feels like I've really transitioned up here into Sydney completely now. And it's a fresh set of eyes and personalities to help me achieve the results up here. So that's super exciting.
Wow, that's really interesting. I feel like this 6 months, and initially when we decided to take a break to look at where we were with the podcast, it wasn't going to be 6 months. We were hoping to get it done in three, which just goes to show you how life happens sometimes. But in a similar way, this idea of transition, I really feel like those 6 months have aligned with everything else that's been going on, and particularly because we sat down and looked at, if we're going to continue this, why are we going to continue this? And that idea of having a particular focus driving us forward, and that idea of creating change, which is what we both want.
That's really interesting. And I think that's the thing, the past 6 months felt like a long time in some ways, but it's funny how time just slowly shifts your direction. And I feel like we're in a space now where, you know, hopefully it feels like we've been doing all this work in the background and now it's the opportunity to share it with the world, which is exciting.
When you talk about chatting to each other and the world about what we've been up to, it is a really great opportunity to see how the reflection of what you're doing in your career bounces off what's going on for me and vice versa. I really love that. So thank you. And, you know, it's been a huge 6 months. My film.
Understatement of the year. Tell me more.
Well, I should say our film has now screened three times to the public, twice through Flickr Fest, once in Sydney and once in Melbourne, and more recently for the Gold Coast Film Festival, where it picked up a couple of awards. And that's been a real full circle achievement and experience for me. You know, I started the year with the impending world premiere of the film, but with a real sort of uncertainty for the year and what else would be happening, and not in a negative way, just that there were lots of possibilities. I wasn't sure what would be happening. And that's probably different from how I felt in other years. So I just wanted to share a few things that I've learnt in the last 6 months and that I'm continuing to learn.
Please.
So I'm learning the value of my time.
Time is, well, you know, we talk about time a lot on this podcast, but you can't talk about it enough, because being able to value your time and understanding, and I think you're going to go into this shortly probably around this, but this understanding of, you know, that sometimes you do need on time, sometimes you need off time, and then you also know the value of what, let's call it the hour that you spend or little pockets of time that you spend, what is that worth to people and to yourself?
Yeah, and you're completely right, and you often remind me of this idea of what it's worth to other people, and when we talk about what we're doing for the podcast, how we can be spending our time best. But I think it's also been about just acknowledging to myself that my time and my experience is valuable, which is not something I've necessarily done in the past. So yeah, but it's been interesting. The last 6 months have not been all been up. There's been lots of frustration and disappointment too, and just being like, well, that's okay. That's just part of it. So yeah. Really happy, really happy to be back, Nick.
What an exciting time to be back too. And you know what? We can't wait. I must say this. We can't wait to be sharing our lives again with you and the lives of others in this Revised podcast, which we are all about challenging the human experience. So wait no longer. Here we are, our first interview of Chapter 2. Please enjoy. Okay, we are here today with writer, performer and comedian Maysa Abuzaid.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, Maysa. I first heard you speak on the panel at the MEAA Summit late last year, and it's so exciting to have you here with us today. To get started, let's hear a bit of your story.
I'm Maysa. I have low vision and I'm Italian, Egyptian, Muslim, female comedian with a female guide dog. I'm no tragedy. I have a little left eye. It's my good eye. It's my good side. It's my compadre. It's my amico. It's my mate. We're attached. We grew up together. We've been through shit together. We hang out. My little left eye, we have an understanding. Islam and disability, dogs are viewed as dirty. So imagine me at uni trying to get my guide dog into the prayer room. So, I got a female dog, because only female dogs can go in the prayer room at uni. I'm not sure if my dog has to wear the scarf, wash her feet, do the wudu. The Islamic chicks at uni reckon I have to leave my dog in the shoe area. And I'm like, that dog is worth 35,000 bucks, and you want me to leave her in the shoe area? Are you kidding? She's coming in to pray. Dogs have religious rights too, you know. Now I'm a social worker, using humour for inclusion, with my guide dog guiding the way. I will always be a theatre writer and performer. It is my survival in the messy world.
Thank you, Maysa.
Beautiful.
Thank you for sharing your story. I'm really excited about this. I love the fact that we've got Clementine, your guide dog, sitting at our feet right now.
Hanging
asleep.
Out.
Asleep. Not interested in the interview, you know?
Asleep.
Hey, look, there's so much to unpack here. As you said, you're a self-described, low-vision, Italian, Egyptian, Muslim, female comedian. I mean, that statement immediately gives us a sense of, I guess, your unique place in the comedy world.
Yes.
But it also, you know, the variety of audiences who can relate to you are quite vast, right, considering that. What do you believe the advantages of this uniqueness brings to your art?
It's if you put me on stage, I'm guaranteed five of my cousins will come, my Australian-born cousins. So everyone is saying, we don't have diversity in our people that visit our theatres. I'm like, just put me on stage.
Yeah.
There's – you remember say that – or what I said on the panel, I remember saying that exact kind of quotation about putting more diverse people on stage so then we do create more diverse audiences that come to our – that come to our theatres.
So it's a story that hasn't been heard, I guess, with that diverse nature of...
Yeah, and also I guess there have been some amazing disability comedians that have done some incredible work and have paved the way and talking about disability as a culture and as a community than an actual medical way of looking at disability. So then there's all those changes. So then...
And it's not just that. I was speaking to Nick earlier because we're interviewing a couple of people today, and I just think it's really exciting with your cultural background, a female comedian. It means that, you know, we think about what we can offer to audiences and how they can relate to what we're going through, and there's so many different angles of how to relate to your passage through the world, I suppose. I just think it's really exciting.
Yeah.
So a lot of comedians obviously use their senses to assess their audience, and some of them use it to garner material. Can you take us through the experience of what it's like not to be able to see your audience and how that affects your craft?
Whenever you're on stage, I think we're all blind because the lighting is so strong. Even if you had vision, you still can't see your audience.
Yeah.
So we're all blind up there.
That's a really good point.
I think they can probably see the first two rows if you're lucky, but I don't think so. Because once you're on stage, those lighting is like boom.
Yeah.
So everyone is blind when they're performing.
Wow, so. that's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
Isn't it?
What, I guess the question I have too
it's,
as well.
It's lighting design.
Yeah, it's lighting design. That's what it is.
No, but it's, when I'm performing, I think about how I can feel the audience, like the feeling I get from them and...
Yeah.
I don't know, how do you feel like you connect?
The energy of the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Outdoor gigs is usually avoided when it comes to doing comedy because it's such an intimate performance. You are essentially a storyteller. And
the energy disperses rather than being kept in the room.
I think the Arab American Comedy Festival, that audience was a comedy audience and the energy was amazing. And then I guess the pub audience is a pub audience.
Yeah.
I remember getting heckled for the first time. I was like this cute little 20-year-old, 19-year-old, I think, and it was like a figure. It was a fundraiser for Guide Dogs Victoria. It was called Blinded by the Light, and it was at a pub, big pub, comedy club. And it was, I remember I was doing a joke about my Arabic background and I was just leaning on my white cane. I just had it on my elbow and I was just leaning on it. And then someone just decided to call me a terrorist. And then I was pretty cute and I just said, I looked really good, you know, and I just said, sure I am. What am I going to use?
Yeah, yeah.
Like meaning, I don't think I make the A grade.
I'm working on
using,
it.
Yeah, so.
Using that.
So it's the energy of the environment that you're in. And I was the only female on that liner of comics. All those ones were all male comics as well. So there's that was the late, I think it was probably 2007, that gig.
And so just speaking a little bit about, I guess, some of the content you've used, and I won't obviously railroad your jokes, but there's an amazing story. You've spoken in certain forums about the sympathy voice that people sometimes adopt with you.
Oh, the shit that I put up with when people realise I'm blind.
Yeah, you called them the blind helpers as well, and there was that particular story where the reference comes from the man on the bus who the bus driver missed his stop.
Yeah, you missed the blind girl stop. You missed Where'd you get your license?
You know, proceeded to then, that's kind of not the right way to do things, right? So my question is, where's this misguided attitude from society come from, do you think? Is it a lack of awareness in regards to disability perception, or what is it, do you think?
Well, I don't know if it's every country has their own culture towards disability, or it's what area you live in that people have a better understanding, or is it, I always believe that if someone grew up with a family member that has a disability, they tend to have a lot more understanding than someone that has never had any exposure. Like I've been on some dates and I've asked a guy, I'm like, what's your, just straight out, I go, so what's your awareness of disability? And they're like, oh, I've done a sign language class. I'm like, oh, so you've got very minimal understanding of disability and culture.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, I think it's...
It's experience.
Yeah.
Awareness. Yeah, it's... I think the people that I've met that have been the most nice has been people that work in special needs schools, because they have that patience and they have that, or the education system needs to include disability in their curriculum, that you have to study disability studies. As a social model, not as a medical model.
Yeah.
So I feel like as performers, something that connects us is that we often need to go to a vulnerable place to achieve our craft. That's kind of required of us. I know we had a really interesting conversation earlier today, Nick, about different types of vulnerability. But that aside, can you talk to us about what you feel like your most vulnerable moment as a performer has been, and what you got out of that?
I did do an acting class a few years ago when I did a study abroad program, and it was, I was quite, it was a very great experience, and I think that's what made me an even better performer coming back home. I can't remember what part of that training that was made me put me in a vulnerable situation to make me great. I think it was just working on plays and... No, I haven't gone there yet. Maybe when we go to New York next year, maybe. Do the Stan Adler stuff. That's crazy.
So, okay, let's talk about your creative process a little bit further, because your work is largely autobiographical.
Yeah.
So when inspiration strikes at any point, I'm just interested, how do you generally capture your jokes, structure your shows? Do you have a particular method in how you like to rehearse? Mm-hmm. You know, like things like that. Is it like, how do you capture jokes? Is it via audio record? How do you capture those?
I guess I scribble down an idea in a scrapbook.
Yeah.
And then I go to the computer and I expand that idea.
Yeah.
And then, I'm very much paper-based when it comes to idea scrap, writing down. I wrote my own first play. It did have a bit of comedy in it. And it was for Melbourne Fringe, and it was called Nest. And I remember just sitting out in the city, outside one of the churches on Swanson Street. And then I just remember sitting there on the grass, and I just had a scrapbook, and I just started writing down what I wanted the play to say. And then
that just came to you, or you?
Yeah. And then I think went home and typed it up, and then I spoke to a mentor at the time with St. Martin's Youth Theatre.
Fantastic.
And then I was on the Catapult program that year. And then we started developing the piece, and then the following year was at Melbourne Fringe. And then same thing with a piece that I wrote for Play for Australia, and I was at the Arts Centre. I wrote it, I think it was a scrapbook and just me sitting on my bed, and then the next day I sat at the computer and I started expanding it, the idea of, but I didn't write about myself, I wrote about a friend. So I wanted to leave myself, but still the same theme of home and nest, and it was about a friend of mine that came here by boat, and I just expanded his, and put that in the piece from the interview I did with him. And then when I did the interview, I scrapbooked everything. I did use the RMIT library room, but the computer wouldn't let me in the system, but that was everyone. The system was me. So I didn't have a chance to type it and email it to myself, so I ended up just scrapbooking it. And getting all those responses from doing that interview, and then I pursued to do the play.
Do you find by getting it up and verbalising it as well, you find the funny, or is it more come through the process of writing and then this is funny anyway so I can deliver it? Does that make sense?
I think it's rehearsing.
Nick has a burgeoning stand-up comedian inside.
I do,
inside,
so I'm very interested.
Don't tell him too many of your secrets.
I'm interested to know, like, because sometimes I find that's the easiest way is if I'm up and I deliver it, I can think it's funny on paper, and then I get up and I'm like,
You have to, you got to troubleshoot it. You got to test it out.
So you've mentioned... you've mentioned briefly your experiences with comedy in New York, which I just think is something we absolutely need to ask about.
Because it's on YouTube as well.
We've checked it out. But just this idea of, early in your career, you were brave enough to head over to New York to ply your wares in the comedy scene.
Yeah.
And we both think that that is pretty amazing, incredibly courageous stuff. We know from our own experiences that getting a show off the ground is completely and often utterly terrifying, especially when it's autobiographical. So we'd love to hear about what made you decide to take such a big step and so early on, and how the experience went.
A few years prior, I did go to the US to do stuff for the School for the Blind at the time. So yeah. I have travelled to the US before as a 14-year-old and as a 16-year-old with a group with other kids that had low vision. And I think one girl was totally blind. I think, we had one total and the rest were all low vision. And we went and did US Space Camp. And so I've done that flight before to LA to wherever in the US we had to go.
Yeah.
So I knew it was possible. Yeah, so I literally did Google my way, and I know on the fly it says Mesa Googled her way to New York, and that's very, very true. And I think I was in year 12. I Googled it, and then it said it was shut. The things were shut for the auditions, but I still wouldn't be able to have gone because I was still doing year 12.
Yeah.
And I had it in my mind, and then the following year we sent off an audition tape to be part of that festival. The nice thing is I remember they put me in the upcoming comics, but they also put me in the two headliners as well. I had the privilege of being in the two headliners, so which was the opening night, the closing night, and then also the closing show and the upcoming. So I did three gigs.
That's intense.
Was an 18-year-old though.
Yeah. It's intense.
Yeah. That was 10 years ago though.
But yeah, I know, but like, yeah, that's exactly my point. Yeah. Like that's just starting. It's taken me years to get the courage to do stuff that I thought about doing decades ago, you know.
Yeah.
Were you petrified? Yeah. Were you nervous or just so excited?
I think I didn't perform great though. I think I think when I watch back there's part of me that's apologizing on stage, which is not something I would do.
Yeah.
I think I was just too young.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess now you've said that was 10 years ago, over the past 10 years, because that was pretty much kind of the start of things.
Yeah.
So in this past 10 years, have you been able to tap into a community?
I went into theatre. I moved over to theatre. I did the odd comedy, but I moved into doing more theatre work because I was at uni and I was doing theatre.
Well, we might explore that in a second. But I was going to say that both with the comedy stuff and the theatre stuff, did you start to find a community of like-minded comedians and live performers that you could connect with? Or do you feel like you're
actually? I think I met one or two friends that are both that do theatre, but not so much comedy though. Mm. And then we ended up doing the Great Victorian Bike Ride. I had them on the front of my tandem. We went from being in the arts to doing, and then we were like everyone called us the tandem girls because we were just on the tandem.
Oh, brilliant. they were pedaling too though, right?
Yeah. We're doing all the work.
Yeah. So that's what I did with a friend of mine that's also involved in doing Melbourne Fringe work and theatre. I guess it's difficult to make relationships that can do work together and move on, because I've noticed that I've met people, they get fascinated, but then they already have their own.
Yeah.
And it's usually very male. I've noticed a lot of in the ethnic comedy though.
Ethnic comedy.
I was going to say, and I feel like more in the comedy world than the theatre world. Is that, would that be right?
When it comes to like groups like an amazing comedy group, I know they're just really lovely guys. I've never met them, but they sound really lovely in the work they do. Sushi Mango, they're four guys. WOG TV, they're three, four guys.
Yeah.
And then when they do impersonate women, they come a bit aggressive, and I'm like, that's not women, you know. I enjoy their work. I find them funny too. I find them incredibly funny. I feel like when I meet people that are doing comedy and they're from an Arabic background or an Italian background, they seem to always collaborate with males and then work with males.
Yeah,
I could be wrong. I could be, but that's what I've found so far.
There you go.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's so hard. I mean, Nick and I met working on a show in 2010, but it was 5 years later that we sort of ended up collaborating.
Yeah, where
we
said,
this.
Hey, we are on the same wavelength with these things.
Yeah,
so
like
maybe
it takes time to find
that.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. And obviously you do a theatre show and you get so tight, you often get so tight-knit with the cast during the play.
Yeah.
And afterwards you might not necessarily see people.
Especially, I guess, on the comedy circuit too. You kind of do shows together with people and then it's like, oh, see you later. And you might not see them for 2 or 3 years, right? Or till the next year's comedy festival or whatever it might be.
We'll be back shortly with the interview.
Mm-hmm.
with our new Toolkit Challenge segment. And this month's topic is tax time.
We've each got 60 seconds on a timer to give our top three practical tips on how to approach tax time as an artist. Are you ready, Lauren Bailey?
Are you ready, Nick Kane? Gain, I should say. I'm setting the timer.
So I'm first.
Got my timer in my hand. On your marks.
Yep.
Get set and go.
Okay, first tip, get yourself a tax shoebox. Number one tip, go out and buy yourself a pair of shoes, grab the shoes out of the box, get a Sharpie and write on the box tax time. Every receipt you get, place it in the box. If you're really switched on, you'll break it up by a quarters. But the idea is by the end of the month, you will have no headache. The idea is you can hand your box over to the tax man. If you're nice like me, you'll create a spreadsheet. But the idea is you've got everything in one spot. It's golden. And remember, be diligent. File it as soon as you get it. Okay, moving on. Tax tip number two, make tax your passion. I love this one. So the idea is if you've got time to rehearse, you've got time to block out time for doing your taxes and keeping your affairs up to date. Be professional and tax is a part of that, okay? Final one, I've got 10 seconds. Here we go. No. Invest in your earnings in bettering your craft, all right? So any money you make out of being an artist, you put
it
back into your craft, okay? Be professional. All I want to say, Lauren, I'm going to finish that.
Go on, give us the last one.
This was actually from a mate once said to me, he goes, every cent I earn, I put it back into my craft. So if I earn $10 this year on my craft, or if I earn 20 grand on my craft this year, every cent goes back to acting classes or voice classes, whatever it might be. I'm not into this idea of being the starving artist. I believe that you've got to put money back into your art to better your craft. So the idea there being is please invest your earnings into bettering your craft.
Okay.
Well, did that scare you? Because it's your turn now, Lauren. You've got to try and get your 3 points out.
I'm a little nervous.
You're
only scared by the important things, right? Okay, here we go.
That's it. I'm setting the timer. Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. 3, 2, 1, and go.
Okay, my first one is claim your agent. This is pretty simple, but it's important to remember that if you are represented by an agent, at tax time you can deduct any fees or commissions that they've charged you throughout the financial year. Can be easy to forget, but important to remember. My second one is fitness expenses. I don't know if you know, but you can only claim a deduction for your fitness expenses if it can be shown that these were required to undertake any strenuous physical activity that might have been part of your income earning activities. So, for example, if you're a trapeze artist like the amazing – oh, no, she's a circus artist. No, she's a cheerleader, the amazing Josephine Kropp. I'm losing time. Gym fees are not a deduction. However, depending on your policy, you can claim these through your private health fund. So I can claim up to $500 a year for gym fees. And some policies also cover expenses for personal trainers. 10 seconds. Lastly is my did not know. I did not know that you can claim a deduction for the cost of tinted contact lenses to alter your eye color for a role. And you can claim... I've gone over.
You have gone over. There it is. But I'd like you to finish your point, Lauren. Yeah. Tell us this last point.
My last one is like going to be so valuable to everyone. Get ready. We're all going to need to know this at some point. You can claim printing.
Hit us.
You can claim printing, postage, and stationery costs incurred for applying to your fan mail.
Oh, yes.
Get out there and buy some stationery, peeps. That's manifesting what you want to happen. Go and buy some stationery today. But keep the receipt.
Here I am,
and put it in a
shoebox. See that. Oh, so Lauren, now you can claim all those photos, those headshots that you've got sitting directly behind you at the moment
Accumulated over the years. Have you got your head? I've got all my headshots that you used to get printed in like multiples of however many, and you'd send 10 out to agents, and then you've got 500 left in your shoebox.
Can I tell you a funny story? I actually
I hope
did
you will.
Send. I got a, I got a letter from someone after I was on a show from the UK, and I decided to send them a letter, but I didn't get the letter till like literally a year and a half after they had sent it. So
what?
I feel like at the time they were a teen, right? Probably, you know, going, oh, how cool is this? Now they were well above 18, so it's like they probably got my fan mail and went, this guy, oh. Remember him? So awkward. That's the only time I've ever sent fan mail to someone. And I can't believe I admitted that.
Well, I haven't sent fan mail, but I did do a show years ago when I was at university at the Trades Hall, and I turned up one night before my call and I met a guy on the steps, and he's like, oh, how are you? And I'm like, good, thanks. I'm off to do this show. Anyway, it turns out, unbeknownst to me, he came and watched the show. And about a month later, I received a letter, care of La Trobe University Drama Department.
Ooh.
And it was fan mail. It was just him being lovely and like, I saw the show and thanks so much. How cool is that?
There we go. Do you know what? I love that this segment turned from us giving tax tips to bragging about our fan mail, which we've got a total of one each, which is nice.
You've got to start somewhere.
That was Toolkit Challenge, Tax Time Edition.
We hope there was something in there, for you.
Back to the interview.
World, and particularly a country where many things that you hang your hat on as defining you as an individual are hot political topics. Western society, on one hand, is becoming less accepting, especially of the Muslim religion. Gender equality has certainly not yet been achieved here, and our government's attitude to the refugee crisis and intolerance towards culture and race is very sadly reflective of a large part of Australian society. Do you, as an artist, feel directly affected by these attitudes? And do you feel also, as an artist, that you're able to make a difference with such big issues?
Without realising, I probably do, especially the play that I wrote for Vessel Arts, which was performed at the Arts Centre, and I called it Less, and it was about a friend of mine that was in detention. But I guess I do write about what I feel, what I see and I feel is happening to our communities, and I guess a lot of my comedy is about how I want to survive. So I guess that's where I would sit in the political yuckiness and how to make art out of it.
Is that overwhelming for you, or is that a positive? Like, do you feel like through social work you're getting tools that
using a lot of, they teach you how to be use strength-based approaches and so forth. And I wanted to be able to do in the future when I'm too old to be in the arts, I guess that there is, maybe there is no. There
I was going to
no,
say, is there a too old no, for someone needs to tell me about this? Yeah.
That I ideally in the future bring my social work and my arts together.
Well, I certainly hope that you don't wait till you're too old for the arts to do that, because I think that's something that sounds like this a really important,
amazing healing aspect that, and around survival and helping other people through your story and through your skills. That sounds really, really amazing. A possibility, anyway, an opportunity. Whether you can connect that just yet, but hopefully it happens in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where the healing, that's where the making it better can start.
Yeah.
In your story, you did provide some context for the world of Islam and disability. You've mentioned to us that, you know, there is quite a bit happening there that can be at both times painful but also needs to be spoken about. Mm-hmm. Are you happy to talk more about that?
Yeah, it's I guess there's the media that's putting pressure on the community or putting negativity on the community, and then there's even within the community there's negativity among the groups as well, with every community there are. That's across not just the Islamic community. I think every community is like that as well. There's always external influences, and there's also internal in the community. And then when you have a disability and you identify with a disability strongly, like I do, a lot of people that have low vision wouldn't use a cane or a guide dog. They don't want to be identified as that. And then there's a lot of shame associated with that. And I think of my growing up, you use the cane or you just accept it. You let it be, and then you move on and do all sorts of things, but you got to accept it. And the community is a bit. I remember going through Broadmeadows Shopping Centre because I was just in the area, and I noticed there were a lot of new arrivals, and I could tell they were new arrivals because I could tell they were speaking Iraqi Arabic. My Arabic isn't great, but I can tell that it's not Egyptian Arabic, and I can tell that's a different dialect. And I was walking past, and they got all frightened, and then they decided to pull their their kids in, and then the kids started wandering, and they were all just all frightened. Maybe because dogs are used as military dogs. I don't know. They probably have bad experiences. Usually if you come from war, you usually have. But so I just walked as quick as I could so then I wouldn't distress them too much. And it's so there's many layers of the relationships of dogs with marginalized communities. I think even Africans, when I meet a Muslim that loves dogs, I'm like, that's amazing, and I'm incredibly happy to meet you. Thank you very much, and I'm very, very thankful. But there is a cultural misunderstanding as well with about saying that dogs are dirty, you shouldn't come in contact with their saliva, which is all wrong. My dog gets washed, because now that I work full time, my dog gets washed once a week now.
Yes. So can I just say, she's soft.
She's incredibly soft, and she's very silky. And there's nothing wrong with the saliva, personally for me. But I have known some guide dog handlers wear gloves. Islamic guide dog handlers wear gloves because of that.
Right.
But I don't see that as an issue for me. And yeah. They're clean. They're very, very clean. We say that all the time to taxi drivers. We say that to the wider community that they're not dirty. I remember putting a sign up in the prayer room and it saying guide dogs are clean. Guide dogs do not bite. Guide dogs are not aggressive. And they are very kind and they're working dogs. I remember putting – and, yeah, it was just a bit of awareness work, and I even had my dog trainer come out and speak to them. So I did a bit of work. I did as much as I did what I could. And then in the end, I ended up leaving my guide dog in a neighbouring office where they absolutely loved her. So
that worked out.
So, yeah. I compromised and it was fine. That was totally fine. And so, it was a funny situation. I remember saying that specific story to my artistic director at the time, and she was writing that joke for me, and she wrote that joke, and she's like, she's got to... And I was saying, she's worth a lot of money. I can't believe I have to do this.
Yeah, that's right. It's like leaving your Porsche out in the street, isn't it? It's a garage, a nice garage.
Yeah.
So just one more question to finish today, and it's really about the future. I recently had the pleasure of working with an amazing blind Japanese lady from IBM called Dr. Cheko Asakawa. Her title within IBM is actually Master Inventor. Can you imagine having that title? And she was working on technology that can help vision impaired and blind people recognize facial expression and also spatial awareness using artificial intelligence at the forefront of technology for people with low vision. When you hear stories like that, can you imagine sort of a near future how that might, number one, help you just in day-to-day life, but also with your creativity?
I think that makes a way for a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
It's like,
I love the way that you think.
I love that. That's brilliant.
It's like, I can think of a lot of material already thinking, my bionic thing has told me that this person is that.
Yeah, you look unhappy.
And is unhappy. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, one of her things is that, you know, she looks at an apple and it says, this is an apple. And then she looks at a packet of chips and it says, this is a packet of chips. You've gained 5 kilograms since yesterday. Maybe go for the apple. So there is comedy there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so it's clearly got it.
There is. Your future self is not happy.
Yeah, that's right. Brilliant. So it sounds like you like the idea of that because there's like a wealth of comedy that can come out of the possibilities.
It's like we're becoming bionic. What's next? We're going to be I watch a bit of Star Trek. So I like Star Trek. So I'm going to be a Borg next month.
Do you think your next performance will be comedy or will it be theatre? Or will it be a mixture?
There's always going to be comedy. Yeah. Whatever I write, there's always going to be
something. Okay, here's my question. What's something you learned about yourself recently?
That I can write, I don't have to write about myself. That's something that I'm really amazed about because I'm like, I'm always writing about myself. But a lot of people say when you write your first book, when people write their first book, they always write about themselves.
Yeah.
So I think my journey has always been about myself. And then I'm really glad that October of last year I was able to make a piece of work that wasn't me. It was my style, but it wasn't my story.
That's nice.
So I reckon that's pretty cool. So I could interview someone and then I can go write a piece and then...
I reckon that is pretty cool.
Have that authorship. which is pretty neat.
That's pretty cool. Well, Mesa, thank you so much for your time. We look forward to coming and seeing your next show, P.S. Oh, so no, keep us in there.
And if you want help with your acting CV, you just let me know. I'm so excited about what you're up to and the good that you're doing for the world. So
thanks for your time.
Go you.
Oh, thank you very much.
So the lasting memory of Mesa's interview for me was her courage to share, I guess, what could be considered her vulnerabilities, Lauren Bailey, you know, turning them into strengths and turning them into stories that resonate. Yeah. That's what I really loved. Her ability to be brave with her art and not fuss about it and still do it with a sense of humour really resonated with me.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Nick. What's your takeaway from that for how you're approaching your month ahead, do you think?
Yeah, I love this. This is actually a new part of what we're doing with the podcast too, is going, we've just had the interview. What can we bring into our month, you know, from that interview that will inspire us and kick us on with our own careers? My thing would be, I started talking to her about stand-up, and that for quite some time I was thinking about, I guess, taking a leaf from her book and just having the courage to start, not fuss, and just do.
Does that mean you're doing stand-up?
Well, what it means, let's just rewind a little.
The thought of that terrifies me. That's why I ask.
Well, it does, but it's also kind of this intriguing thing. It's been on my bucket list for quite some time. Yeah. And so what I'm thinking is, let's start the process. Why not this month? The inspirational take from Mesa is this month, I'm going to book a little writing retreat. I'm going to go away from Sydney, find a little cabin, maybe an Airbnb type number, and just for 2 days over the weekend, find the focus to maybe write a show. What do you think?
Wow. Yeah, I think that sounds fantastic.
Well, it does, doesn't it? I think hopefully I can report back next month and let you know how it all went. You know, it could be a blazing success. It could be
that funny. It makes me think about your tip 2 for tax time. Yes. That idea of, if we can block time for rehearsals, then we can block time for doing our tax, and we can choose to block out time for whatever it is that is holds value for us.
That's a really great point. I think, you know, even the best, even the best CEOs, if you look at companies, if you look at their diaries, they're actually not spending more time than the sort of people underneath them. The idea is they block out time in their diary to, because they're so busy, to spend with their kids or to go away and be proactive about their career. So if we're going to be professional about our careers, we have to do the same thing. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. Block some time to just go away and write without distraction.
Yeah, well, I think that sounds fantastic.
Well, what about you, Lauren? What were your takeouts and what will you thread into your month?
In some ways, I am pretty much on the same page as you, Nick. Mesa is such an amazing individual and I'm overwhelmed by her courage and strength. We've spoken about this before, the buzz that we get from speaking to guests for the podcast, talking to them about how they've faced challenges in their careers and how they what they draw on to continue to share stories and spread awareness and bring joy to people. And it was really lovely to sit down with Mesa. You know, you can feel her joy and her openness and her determination to move forward. And just so inspiring. And this, I've talked a bit throughout the podcast about the idea of focus for me at the moment. We've got a really clear focus on where we're headed with the act of storytelling. That's helped me look at my career and where I'm headed. And I have been working with a coach over the last, well, it must be nearly the 6 months that we've been working on the relaunch. We're working on a plan for the year ahead, which will align with the next financial year. It's given me the opportunity to really consolidate things I'm already working on, promoting In Life Today, working on next steps for funding and development for that. But it's also helped me feel like I have clarity on what I'd like to be achieving and when and how that might happen. And in a way that, you know, there's so much about our careers that we can't have 100% clarity on or know when the next audition is or if we'll book it. So it's nice to have some clarity so that I can open myself up to the excitement of uncertainty and possibility in other areas of my life.
I love that. You know, there's a real focus, I feel, in this podcast about professionalism. You in regards to how you run your career and your life. And I really love that. And it might be something to do with the purpose and direction that we've taken with this podcast.
Yeah.
But I love that because it's about blocking out time to really be active rather than that kind of reactive, more proactive than reactive. So I love that.
It's really helped to have people you can reflect off and bounce ideas off. And so thank Bloody you for oath. That, Nicholas Kane. Bloody oath. And that, of course,
Bloody oath.
Brings us to the end of podcast one for chapter two of the Act of Storytelling. And if you, our listeners, are excited about the new shape and focus of the podcast or have any other feedback at all, we would love to hear from you either on Facebook or at theactofstorytelling @gmail.com. And, of course, we'd love you to leave us a review on iTunes, which would be really helpful.
Make our day. And, you know, we're going to continue to expand the podcast offering too, and we're going to work on providing you, our listeners, I guess, as much inspiration and practical support for your career as we can. And I guess to be able to do that, we're working on ways to financially support the podcast. So we've launched a GPS audio tour of Melbourne's laneways. We did that over Christmas time. It's through a platform called VoiceMap, and it's been getting a great response. So if you'd like to download and check it out, you can download the VoiceMap app for free on Android and iPhone. And the tour itself is $5, which will just go towards covering some of the costs of the podcast.
And you get to listen to us again.
You do.
If that's
our dulcet tones.
And you can also make a one-off donation through our website at theactofstorytelling.com.au. And any donations of $10 or more receive a very cool Teos bookmark, which was designed by the wonderful Bethany Smith, who we interviewed in the first year of podcasting. Mm-hmm. And if you'd like to be a patron of the podcast, for as little as $1 a month, you can sign up at patreon.com/actstorytelling. And there are some really cool perks on there as well. So even if you're not sure about signing up as a patron, please head over there and sort of see what we're up to. You can follow us there and get updates and all of that sort of thing. A number of creative professionals have helped us shape this next chapter of the Act of Storytelling.
Yes, indeed. And we would like to say thank you to all these incredible people for their talent and generosity.
For composition and performance, Anita Quayle.
Mixing and mastering, Colin Wynn at 30 Mill Studios.
Web design, Jennifer Piper.
Photography, Taryn Walker at Muse Photography.
Graphic design, Marion Gurino.
And sound design, Michael Ladson at Noisy Street Designs.
And hopefully we didn't make that sound too much like an Oscars nomination list.
Well, there it is. Chapter 2, Podcast 1. Continue to join us on the Act of Storytelling into the future.
And thanks for listening.